I'm David Ropeek, and this is The Connection. Their motto is Fidelity, Bravery, Integrity, FBI. Would you settle for one out of three? They may be brave, but there are serious questions about the Bureau's fidelity and certainly its integrity. Outgoing Director Louis Free is in the hot seat on Capitol Hill today to answer for the Bureau's foul-up, or was it a cover-up, the failure to provide thousands of papers in the Oklahoma City bombing trial to lawyers for Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. But that mistake is just one of many. Protection for mobster informants who murdered in Boston. Allegations of faked evidence at the Ruby Ridge shooting in Idaho in 1992. Charges that workers from the famed FBI forensic lab knowingly gave false testimony in a number of high-profile cases. Outgoing FBI Director Louis Free has said, quote, "We who enforce the law must not merely obey it. We have an obligation to set a moral example which those whom we protect can follow," end quote. Connection listeners, what do you think of the example the FBI is setting? Is the shine off the badge? And is this latest case of the McVeigh papers evidence of American justice at its best or worst? The number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. And we are joined by fascinating guests today for this conversation. In a studio in Chicago, Rob Warden, Executive Director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions, Northwestern University School of Law. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, Lois Romano, national reporter for The Washington Post, who has covered the Oklahoma City bombing for 6 years. And in Coventry, Rhode Island, Kate McCauley, former Timothy McVeigh defense investigator and one of five people invited by him to witness his execution. Thank you all for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. Lois, let me start with you because I think we all want to know what's the latest. What is up with the papers? What's up with appeals?
Well, yesterday, the FBI field offices informed Louis Free that that's it. They've handed everything in. Now, who knows if that's really accurate because we had these 100 pages that trickled in from Baltimore on Friday. So, but the FBI is now saying that they have everything. Everything's been turned over to the field offices in Oklahoma City and then to the McVeigh attorneys. I think the next step in this whole process is going to be to watch for is whether Mr. McVeigh's defense attorneys file for a stay. I mean, basically, they really can't do a whole lot in 30 days. And I think strategically, they're weighing not only whether to do the stay, but timing-wise, what would be an appropriate time to do it.
Lois, there's some talk about whether this will lead to a change in the outcome for McVeigh, and most of that talk seems to suggest probably it won't. But let's not forget Terry Nichols out there. His lawyer was talking this morning quite seriously about an appeal that could overturn his conviction and life sentence.
I think actually you're onto something there. I think this could prove to be much more beneficial to Terry Nichols because if you go back to Terry Nichols' conviction, you know, he was convicted on much lesser charges and of course escaped the death penalty. And part of that reason was because the jury believed that McVeigh was the mastermind. And the whole premise of the, you know, the strategical premise of what the lawyers are saying is that if they can prove cause, either sets of lawyers, McVeigh or Nichols, that there was others involved that played a dominant role, it would either affect Mr. McVeigh's penalty. I mean, it'd be kind of hard to envision that his conviction would get overturned, but it could affect his penalty. And certainly with Nichols, it could go to the heart of his conviction.
Well, in the interest of journalistic balance, we tried to get someone from the FBI to comment on this program and couldn't, but this morning a spokesperson for the government, indeed a prosecutor in the case, Beth Wilkinson, had this to say.
This new information, if it does deal with sightings of John Doe 2 and Mr. McVeigh, is very similar to the information that Mr. Nichols and his defense team had long ago and presented during their trial. It did not make a difference in the outcome. Mr. Nichols was still convicted of conspiracy.
Lois, what's the reaction out there amongst the people who now are stunned that this isn't over and it was supposed to have been a couple hours ago, and their pain and their lack of closure goes
on? They're furious. I mean, you know, they're just absolutely furious. They had psychologically and mentally prepared themselves to close this chapter. I mean, not to get closure. They hate saying that. But to basically move on to the next chapter. I mean, for them, McVeigh was the big enchilada. For most of them, anyway. I mean, some of them feel as strongly about Nichols. But I would say the majority, it was McVeigh. That was the chapter they wanted to close. They're tired of hearing from this guy. I mean, every time they feel like it's over, he writes a letter, he goes on a show, he does something, he gives an interview. They just don't want to ever hear from him. And they're very angry at the government right now.
Lois, thank you. Let me turn now to Kate McCauley, because few people in America could give us a better sense of what Timothy McVeigh might be thinking now. Kate, first catch us up to how you came to be involved in 30 seconds or left, and then the question is, what do you think Tim McVeigh is thinking?
Well, you know, I became involved with the citizens group, so I investigated the peripheral information and then eventually worked on McVeigh's appellate team, so I got a chance to look at the other side of the information. And now, of course, you know, I continued to correspond with Tim McVeigh through about, I guess, three and a half years at this point. I can only imagine he's very frustrated for the family. His lawyers have related that he was very depressed over it, even concerned for the town of Terre Haute, which got itself turned up on its ear. And I agree with Lois, by the way. She's absolutely dead on. The victims, this was a benchmark for them. And they have been turned on their ear once again. It's just a shame.
You got to know them, too. As I understand it, you went out to kind of work with them about whether there were conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. And tell us what your opinion was about whether there were those theories, part one of the question. How are those folks feeling today?
I don't know. I think that there was such an emotional upheaval that we haven't even begun to grasp the kind of post-trauma and helplessness and grief that these people felt. And maybe, you know, believing in what people say, because a lot of people said a lot of stuff. I mean, it's so hard to discern who may be saying, you know, maybe reacting to pictures on television as opposed to real things they saw. And I think that that maybe provides some comfort for them. But, you know, there's little comfort to be had in the middle of this situation.
Were the conspiracy theories, a lot of people are going to jump all over this FBI stuff, that it was a cover-up, that there are more documents, that more went on in Oklahoma City than we know. In fact, the militant right is talking about Tim McVeigh having worked with the FBI. They never intended to execute him. He was just covering up what really happened. Give us your sense. You were on the ground there just as an interested person investigating all this. Were there conspiracies, and how will this play into that sense?
I mean, if there's anything out there, it wouldn't me over if I found something tomorrow. I'm not attached to anything, but the problem was is that you have to discern. I mean, you have 50 people in Oklahoma City seeing something within 20 minutes. Tim McVeigh's in a car, he's in a truck, he's jeans, fatigues, he's driving, he's a passenger. Somebody's got to be wrong. So that creates a real nightmare. And of course, with a case like this and an emotional upheaval and a national 800 number, can you only imagine the phone calls that came in?
Yeah,
unbelievable.
Lois, let me ask you this, and thank you both, first of all, for remembering that there are real people and real loss and real pain in what can otherwise be an intellectual exercise. I'm glad we got to that first, and I'm glad you've given us that sense, and we should bear that in mind for the rest of this conversation. But now let's talk a little bit more, Lois, about officially what's happening, the pro and con side, the FBI haters and so forth, and this business of, was it an accident? Was it on purpose? The FBI has a history of this kind of stuff. What are you hearing from your reporting?
I think, listen, I could be wrong about this. We could end up finding out that it was a major cover-up. But I tend to think at this juncture it looks like just raw incompetence, that basically what happened is that, you know, there was a bad information flow that in 1996 or whenever, when Louis Freeh declared the investigation over, and he effectively, you know, it did do that. I mean, once they pulled the John Doe number 2 sketch down and said he didn't exist, that they basically said it was over, and at that point the FBI just stopped sending things to the prosecution. And somewhere along the line, I think the prosecution needed to be reaching out to the FBI also and saying, keep sending stuff. We have this discovery agreement. And maybe just by not asking, it was kind of implicitly silent, because we're talking about thousands of pages. And at one point, there were 12,000 lead sheets. And at a certain point, as Beth Wilkinson had said at one point, it was like Elvis sightings. So, you know, I think maybe it was a combination of, you know, omission by silence with a little bit of incompetence. But the one thing that was kind of interesting is when they did do the call in January for these documents, the FBI spokesman was quoted the other day as saying, well, we saw a couple of things came in, but we wanted to see the magnitude of the problem, so we kept looking. Well, the truth is, the second they had one document they were in violation of the agreement. And the second they had that document had to go up the food chain and be handed over to McVeigh's defense lawyers. And the idea that instead of doing that, they waited 5 months and accumulated 3,100 documents to be presented 5 days before the execution is just a colossal mess up.
Well, let's ask Rob Warden, who's been watching the agency for a long time. Mess up or cover up? There's a history of this.
Well, in this case, there's no evidence that it's anything other than raw incompetence, to borrow Lois's word. However, we have seen in the past that the FBI is perfectly capable of engaging in cover-ups, and the history of the agency is replete with examples of simply egregious civil rights violations, beginning with the disclosure in the early 70s of the COINTELPRO program, that was short for counterintelligence, in which the FBI was literally trying to set up people, and in one case did set up a raid in Chicago in which two leaders of the Black Panther Party were murdered in 1969, and just a series of things up through the disclosures in 1997 of the bad practices in the FBI crime laboratory. So this is just another fiasco in a long line of them.
And that's where our conversation will be going after the break, and we'll remind listeners at the moment that they can join the conversation about both McVeigh and the meaning of it in the overall impression of the FBI by calling 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lois, we have a couple minutes left in this section. What happens next? First, you suggested there might be a stay and the execution might be more than now 20-some days off, but what else?
I think that's the first move. The ball is completely in McVeigh's court now, and so the first move is to make a decision when and if to ask for additional time. Once they do that, they have three ways they can go. They can go back to the district court and reopen a motion, a post-conviction relief motion. They can go to the circuit, but to go to the circuit, they have to prove actual innocence is in those documents, or they can do a direct appeal to the Supreme Court, which is rarely granted. I want to just make the point that they have an uphill battle here. I mean, they've got to show either that those documents show innocence or that they show pretty strong evidence that there was a larger conspiracy and that McVeigh's role was minimized. So I think, you know, they might get the stay, but I'm not sure how far they can go after that since the guy has been, you know, basically putting up billboards everywhere admitting that he did it.
But once again, let's not forget Terry Nichols, and he's making more sounds about appeal. What's next for them?
He got a little break here in Oklahoma. They put off his hearings. Here it was about to start a state trial, so he's in pretty good shape there. He's waiting now for a ruling from the Supreme Court on this very issue that had come up before, whether he can get some of these FBI lead sheets. And again, their threshold is a little lower to prove that there might have been a larger conspiracy and other people and minimize his role, because they've already proved that. They've already proved to a certain extent that McVeigh was the larger mastermind of this. And so they, if they get an overturn, they have a pretty good shot. I don't know if they have a good shot at overturn, but once they do, I think they can make a pretty good case and further minimize his role. Because remember, he never went to Oklahoma City.
And also remember that he didn't confess, as McVeigh did later,
exactly.
But McVeigh has said things about his complicity after the trial, which
exactly.
Could come up in appeal. It's quite a mess. It sounds like it's going to be going on for a long time. And, of course, it should have been over by this morning for Timothy McVeigh. We will continue the conversation in the broader context of whether this is taking some more of the shine off the badge of America's top cops, the FBI, and what this means with our fascinating guests. You can join the Connection conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Thank you to Lois Romano of The Washington Post. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Welcome back to the Timothy McVeigh and FBI Connection. I'm David Ropeek. We're talking about the FBI today, their recent screw-up in the McVeigh case, and whether it's part of a larger pattern. Kate McCauley is with us. She knows Tim McVeigh well. He has asked her to be one of his witnesses at his execution. Kate, he has lots of options available to him.
Yeah.
He could execute them now. Pardon me if I can use that word. He's chosen not to so far. Do you expect that he may change his mind?
I don't know. I'm going to defer to legal counsel at this point. There, you know, there are about a dozen options out there of things you can do. I think what's so upsetting is that they waited until 1 week before his execution. Ms. Romano was completely correct. As soon as they found out, they should have told. But I'll tell you right now, they were fighting like angry stepchildren over exculpatory evidence going back to day one. So I'm not totally surprised. I'm just shocked by their timing.
Well, but I'm asking you, based on your knowledge of the man, whether you think it's likely that he'll take advantage of this, legal options aside, what's in his heart? Is he likely to take advantage of this to keep his crusade going longer, to stay in the front lines, or to get it over with? What do you think?
At this point, I have not communicated with him, so I couldn't even venture a guess. You know, he'll weigh his options with his attorneys, and as a former member of that defense team, that's about as far as I know. He really hasn't shared it with me. I'm sure he's... You know, he's got a keen mind. He'll figure it out. But I'll imagine he's very distressed for what it did to his family, too.
I imagine. And, of course, all the victims' families and a lot of angst in America over this. There's a lot of faith in government that's at stake. And, in fact, that's where the conversation will head now. And we want to bring a little bit more to the conversation. Rob Warden, who has watched this agency and is executive director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions, watched it with a critical eye for quite some time. Talk a little bit more, Rob, about this as a pattern of the agency over the decades.
Well, beginning in the 70s, the FBI image began to be tarnished rather incredibly when, under the Freedom of Information Act, various documents started coming out of the FBI revealing the existence of the COINTELPRO program, in which... the agency literally set out to do things like discredit Martin Luther King Jr., had actually helped plan the raid on the Panther apartment on the west side of Chicago in which Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were killed. An agent provocateur from the FBI, in fact, had taken the weapons into the Panther apartment. The agent provocateur had done all sorts of things to make the Panthers seem to be a far greater threat than they in fact were. He had, for instance, helped construct a proposed building, an electric chair that they would use in case they ever found any informants in their ranks. That was just one example.
And Rob, let me interject. You're suggesting a more ancient history, but you're suggesting the myth started to erode before Ruby Ridge in 92, in which they faked pictures and destroyed evidence. And let me go down a little bit of the litany here just to add in. We've done some research. 93. Waco, regardless of what they did before and during the raid, they did a report saying everything was cool and then later admitted they didn't admit that they knew that incendiary shells had been made. In 96, they target wrongly Richard Jewell for the Atlanta Olympic bombings.
Right.
Here in Boston, they were covering up for mobsters they knew were going out and killing because those mobsters are ratting out mafia members. And they put a guy in jail for 30 years, Joe Salvati, knowing he was innocent, left him there because they didn't want to admit the evidence they had. So there's ancient history. There's current history. What does this do to the public's trust in our top cops?
Well, I hope that it brings the public around to reality, because the reputation of the FBI as this fearless agency that is totally incorruptible, of course, is couldn't be further from the truth. There is not. Someone asked me the other day, can the FBI win back its reputation? And I said, well, there's really nothing to win back. It's had a terrible reputation for since 3 decades ago. It's sort of amazing. I remember once, as a very young reporter in the early 70s, I had an opportunity to talk to Roger Baldwin, the founder of the American Civil Liberties Union, shortly before his death. And it had just been disclosed that various high-level officials of the American Civil Liberties Union had, in fact, been FBI informants. And as Roger Baldwin put it at that time, and I will never forget this, he said, you've got to understand that we really thought at the time that J. Edgar Hoover was a good man. So he'd been very successful in creating this tough-on-crime image, the idea that the feds always get their man. Programs like the FBI on radio and television have created a totally false picture of this agency, which has engaged in malfeasance and when not malfeasance, certainly misfeasance.
Rob, we are joined now, and connection listeners listeners, we are joined now by Dr. Fred Whitehurst. Fred, thank you for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Hi, Fred. How are you doing?
Good morning, Fred.
Kate, you know each other. Good. And please consider this, everyone, a conversation amongst both our guests and our listeners. Fred Whitehurst was a key player in perhaps one of the most significant bungles, screw-ups, cover-ups, whatever you want to call it, and I'll let Fred describe it in a moment. He brought to the FBI's attention, as a ranking member of their famed forensic lab, problems in that lab with not only how they do their science, but how they were telling the truth or not in as many as 3,000 cases. And when he did so, they turned on him instead of fixing the mistakes. Fred, have I introduced you correctly? And flesh out the details for us on your specifics.
Well, I think essentially what's happening there, if you generalize it, is that the rank and file of the FBI, the management of the FBI, don't trust the American people to decide truth and innocence. And so we go into courts of law, we go to the media, trying to manipulate, not to educate. We are supposed to be investigators, and we're supposed to tell you what we find without bias. And I say we because, you know, it's sort of one of these once a Marine, always a Marine, once an agent, always an agent. Of course, I'm no longer in that organization, but that's what it boils down to, manipulation of jurors. And it doesn't surprise me at all or any of my expatriate colleagues that that those documents were withheld. I wouldn't be surprised to find that there were tens of thousands of other documents that were hidden in that case.
Well,
in the McVeigh matter.
Fred, let me go into a couple of the details of your specifics because I think it's illustrative of the cultural questions that your case raises. You brought to management's attention not only that there was dust in the lab that could screw up samples and questionable scientific interpretation of results, but manipulation of how the facts were being presented in several key cases, including Oklahoma City and the World Trade Center. You said then and later they wanted to dictate the truth, not discover it. You called the people in the lab with whom you worked forensic prostitutes. You called the people in the agency broadly testosterone tyrants. That's strong stuff that really can shake an American's faith in these top cops. Talk about the culture of this organization.
Well, as an investigator told my wife when she found out that Criminal Investigation Division agents were stealing computer software, we're the investigators. Nobody's going to investigate us. So there's no worry here. And actually, to the credit of the agency, there were 30 people that stood up with me and backed me up when I came forth with these indications of misconduct. In fact, the forensic prostitution statement was one that came out of the FBI's chief metallurgist, Supervisory Special Agent William Tobin, who said what's being practiced here is forensic prostitution. Not across the board, but in very open, significant instances where we knew who in the lab were the bad guys. Management just took advantage of the bad actors. And, you know, because essentially if you want to convince jurors that somebody's guilty, these are the kind of people that manipulate the facts and present a slanted, biased view of what investigators have found.
Connection listeners, we have some interesting people who can comment on the culture of the FBI and our trust in government and law enforcement. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Jan is on the line with a question. Jan, thank you for joining us.
Hi. I was just going to say it's not shocking to me that this sort of thing's happening now in present day. I mean, we have cases where people like Diablo are getting shot, putting a key inside of his own door. You know, I mean, did it ever occur to these cops that maybe that guy lived there? I mean, we need a system of checks and balances here. We don't really have any regulation.
That's the Mohamed Diallo case in New York City, as I recall.
Yeah.
So you're suggesting other police departments are doing the same sorts of things.
Well, not only the police department, but the government so screwed up in general. I mean, we really need a new form of government, it looks like, because nobody's really checking on other people, and people make mistakes every day. You know, people lie, they cover up, they they falsely accuse people. They put evidence there that wasn't supposed to be there. I mean, this is stuff that's happening right in front of us every day, and nobody's doing anything about it.
Rob, I think you might be appropriate to address that, do you think?
Well, we are. We're trying to do our part to address that, everything that we can do in righting the wrongful convictions that come to our attention. But one of the things, I mean, the caller is just absolutely right. Of course, I think we must add in fairness that this is always a rather small minority of the people in the FBI, a relatively small number of investigations in the sum total. However, the propensity of the nation's top police agency for these kinds of errors and sometimes worse is clear. And for us to maintain a system in which we are literally sending people to their deaths based on the investigative work of this kind of that when it's been shown to be so error-prone is just unconscionable. I don't understand how we can really do this as a society. And I don't think that we need a new form of government. What we really need to do is restore the principles of this government.
If I can add in there,
please,
too,
go ahead.
You know, in the case of the Oklahoma,
this is Jen.
Hi, Janet. In the case of the Oklahoma bombing, the FBI agents interviewed people sometimes 10 and 20 times, and then did not allow the defense to go out and re-interview. So it's not so much you got to change the quality of how things are cataloged, but the quality of the content, because Fred is exactly right. The crime lab problems here are unbelievable. And even after the Inspector General's report, an FBI agent went before an Oklahoma County grand jury and continued to give wrong information. So, I mean, it's the quality of the information and it's the attitude. That's going to be the difficult thing to crack here.
Well, yeah, I agree with the
Kate, thank you. You both sound alike. Jen, go ahead.
Sorry. I was just going to say also, you know, that might be right, but what about cases where people in the Black Panther were shot and it was evidence put there? I mean, what was that all about?
Well,
and
you know,
who wanted them out?
It's almost like, you know, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, it almost seems like we're turning on each other. And I hate to see, you know, huge agencies or even the military in some cases getting involved with law enforcement and kind of coming after its own people. I mean, we keep passing laws and we keep doing things and, you know, and the people are sitting out there. They're pretty helpless because these agencies are so huge and omnipotent. So, yeah, Janet, you're on to something there.
Jan, thank you for calling. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. You make good points about how far we should take this in assuming that everything is bad. Let's talk about them some further. Mary is calling from Providence.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My concern is, and I really love your show, I listen to it all the time, I'm wondering if you are sort of polarizing issues here as opposed to deciphering important things that need to be discussed in terms of the work at the FBI. I have an objection to giving credence to McVeigh's views here. And I don't think this is really a proper forum to discuss it. I think the issues that he brought up are confusing, and the certainly FBI problems are also confusing and hard to decipher. And I'm wondering if they should all be talked about in the same show. I think it's
Well, it's not really about Tim McVeigh. It's about the rules of law. You know, it's a system, basically, and I think it doesn't hurt to discuss this because it only really takes a few people to mess up the work of the good people because now you don't know which is bad and which is good. So it is shades of gray, and I respect the fact that there are a lot of people out there trying to do their job.
Fred, what do you think? There are good cops and bad cops.
Oh, goodness. Most of the people I worked with at the FBI are good. The comment about we need another form of government, it was this form of government that I used, that I went through. Now, it was a very hurtful kind of a process to go through because whistleblowers, and I hate to call myself that, but that seems to be what I am, whistleblowers have no protection under the law at all, despite the fact the law has been passed. But it was our government, it was Congress that looked closely at, and frankly, it was the media that was fantastic as far as I was concerned, that looked seriously and openly at the problem at the FBI lab as, you know, as an indication of other problems, that made that thing work. As a colleague of mine told me from Singapore, in Singapore they'd have just shot you, Fred. Well, I didn't get shot. I walked away from the FBI with what I would have made as an FBI agent, and when I would have retired at 57 in another few years, what I'll make as retirement. And I'm not dead. I'm continuing a campaign to find out who got hurt by all that process and who continues to get hurt. So this is, I have to disagree when we're, you know, the doom and gloom thing. This is a beautiful country. Now, the FBI will hurt you if you expose them. They're going to come after you and have no question about that, and they will do what they can to turn your life upside down. But they don't in the end succeed, or they didn't with me, if they're wrong.
Fred, democracy, as they said, is the messiest form of government except for all others. And I would suggest to Mary, if you're still there, that while the McVeigh case and the larger picture are separated, the McVeigh case does, in a democracy, wave the flag that makes us pay attention to these other issues, especially as it fits into a larger pattern. What do you think?
Well, you know, where one of the barriers that I ran into with people would tell me, look, but you know the guy's guilty. Why are you bringing up these issues? And my problem is that the ways that we use to convict a McVeigh or somebody that's obviously blown up an airplane, that sets precedent in courts of law. If we walk into courts and lie about the science or lie about the evidence, those lies come back to haunt us later. And the innocent people get caught up in that, and we do have a significant number of innocent people, obviously, as the Innocence Projects have been able to show.
And Rob Warden's program.
Yes, yes, absolutely. That they're rotting in cages and in death chambers.
Rob, we have about 45 seconds left before a last break. How many people would you say have been wrongly convicted because of FBI misdeeds, in your judgment? That's a hard number.
Oh, because of FBI misdeeds?
That's correct.
No doubt hundreds throughout the nation, but there's no way really to know. I mean, we can't go out and do, say, a survey in prison, say, hey, how many of you guys are innocent, and get a reliable answer.
They usually call you and all of them say the same thing. We're innocent.
Well, no, I think that a lot of people do, in fact, admit their guilt once they've exhausted their appeals. But, you know, I look at like capital cases in Illinois. We've shown that about 5% of the people who have been sentenced to death since capital punishment was restored here were, in fact, innocent. I think that kind of an error rate is what we're looking at throughout the country.
And 5%. That leads us. Thank you. Rob, we'll be back shortly. Connection listeners, we're talking about the FBI, and in the next segment, how to start to reshine the tarnished badge. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University.
Welcome back to The Connection. We're talking about the FBI, the Timothy McVeigh case, what's gone on in the past, where the nation's top cops are going in the future. We have Rob Warden on the line, executive director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University School of Law, and Fred Whitehurst, who was in the midst of one of the biggest problems that the FBI had, Kate McCauley, who is an investigator and invited by Timothy McVeigh to witness his execution. Let me frame this next conversation with a couple interesting statistics. In the days of Bonnie and Clyde and Al Capone, the FBI had 441 special agents. They now have 12,000. They had a couple offices. They now have 56 regional offices and 400 satellite offices, a $3.5 billion budget. Do we need them, and are they simply too big? Rob?
Well, I think that we certainly need a federal investigative agency but we don't need an agency that is basically going to usurp the role of the local police. We have, you know, state police departments around the country, local police departments, certainly in big cities, that are doing a lot of stuff that's repetitive with what the FBI has done. What I really think we need to do, though, is control the situation. There needs to be accountability at all levels of the criminal justice system, and quite frankly, there just hasn't been the accountability that there should be. The FBI has literally gotten away with, and I mean literally, I mean that literally, with murder.
Well, but let me ask Fred Waithurst. Sometimes they don't, because despite all your travails, you sued the government, you were harassed by the agency, or so you say, and you won that suit, and they paid you. The problems are being fixed at the lab. Are there ways within our system to fix this problem, Fred?
There's already a way to take care of the laboratory and forensic laboratory problems in this country. The testing laboratory audit function, which is taking place in clinical labs, environmental labs, government contract labs, is right there. You can implement it in forensic labs today. There's no billion-dollar implementation. What's happening is forensic laboratories are refusing to be audited and for that audit to be made public. We're being required to buy a product as citizens of this country that we don't even know whether it's good or bad. We're being required to lay out our taxes. And, you know, we get close, and this is going to sound sort of maybe a little out there, but we're getting close to, where that's concerned, dictatorship. Dictating truth, we don't get to discover what the error rate is, despite federal law that says we need to know the error rate. So there's a solution with the forensic laboratories all over state, federal labs. There are problems in forensic labs all over the country. It's just implement a external audit so that legislative bodies can see what they're paying for. If the FBI lab wants to function, it has to tell the American people what its error rate is. And that wouldn't take anything to implement, anything at all.
Fred, thank you. Connection listeners, you can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Mark is calling from Virginia Beach. Mark.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. I think one of the major issues is that there doesn't seem to be any consequences in terms of punishment for those either in the FBI or local law enforcement when they give false testimony or mess up an investigation. And it just seems that, for example, in this case, that there's this long investigative process we can all see that's going to develop as to who is really responsible for what happened. And the sense is nothing will come of that. And also the situation with the woman who was the investigator, I believe the criminal lab investigator in Oklahoma, who's been found to falsify testimony and take science too far over stretching back 15 or 20 years. I mean, it's just incredible. And there just does not seem to be consequences for people who do that.
The omerta, the code of silence within law enforcement, protecting one another. Fred and Rob and Kate, what happens to the good guys when they turn out to be bad guys? They don't seem to go down the way the bad guys do.
Can I say something?
Please.
As a result of the revelations that I brought forward at the FBI, there was only two individuals who lost their jobs at the FBI. That's me and my wife. That's it. I've got the point now where I don't right now worry about accountability because I don't think there's going to be an accountability. I'm concerned about who got hurt. If you're sitting in a prison cell, falsely, wrongly convicted, you would like to get out before you'd like to bring accountability to whoever put you there. And that's all I think. I just don't see how we've got ourselves in a position in this country where we cannot hold the FBI accountable. That's horrendous.
Fred,
I don't know how we can.
Fred, tell me the story, as I recall reading, that you were approached by someone in your early days in the agency with training for how to lie to cover up the agency.
I brought my problems to my training agent, and I said, you know, this stuff will come out in court. He said, don't worry about it, Fred. Before you embarrass the FBI in a court of law, you'll commit perjury. We all do it. Let me show you how. And I went through that process twice. It was appalling to me. I was furious about it, and I was called down because I got angry about it. But that was part of my formal training, sir.
Fred, yeah, the training program and how to shoot and arrest the bad guys and how to lie.
Well, you know, I'm sure that Bureau management, knowing who I am now, would rather that guy not have told me that. But that was the guy assigned to me to be my training agent.
Mark, thank you for your call. Connection listeners, you can join this conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Jack is on the line. Jack?
Jack, hi. I wonder if somebody, are we missing a very possible scenario of this whole incident with McVeigh? All this diatribe about widening this to a terrible scope. This is a terrible crime that was committed in Oklahoma City. And the FBI were there, and they put a lot of people on this case. And just as we would with any other terrorist activity, we can't depend on state police or the local police. And they went out and they studied, came up with a tremendous amount of data. And, of course, they couldn't turn it all over. They read it themselves. And the data that they got was very relevant to McVeigh and his co-partner. I'm sure if they had found something else with regard to somebody else who may have been involved, they could have turned that over to the prosecutor. But I think they may have done their own job. And, of course, the answer to what I'm saying is, why are we going through all these discussions to tear and attack the FBI? Because somebody who got fired there doesn't like the FBI. I think we should wait until the results of the reading of these documents that started this whole thing are read over. If there's anything relevant in there, then maybe a mistake was made. But why don't we wait until the relevancy of the documents that started this whole thing, and now it's a tremendous discussion going on in your program that says the FBI is terrible, they're a bunch of thieves, they're a bunch of crooks. And, you know, the world is full of terrible terrorists. We need something strong to protect us.
Jack, thank you. Kate?
I'm sorry. If I may, if they withhold documents, they actually risk their own prosecution. So
they're withholding documents that are relevant.
But it doesn't matter. It's the rule of law. It's a Brady violation if you don't do that, and the courts frown upon it. They could throw out a correct conviction based on those mistakes. So they're actually not doing themselves very much good because, you know, we're talking about rules of law, not necessarily quality of evidence.
Kate, let me interrupt and ask this question. You don't have any question that McVeigh is guilty, do you? I mean, after all, the FBI, we thought that there was possibly Arab terrorists when it first broke out, and the case was solved. Do you think it was solved correctly?
Well, I mean, you know, I haven't seen, like I said, I'm not talking about the quality of evidence. I'm talking about the rules of law, and that's what the courts are going to look at, too, and say, you know, this guy could get some relief when obviously he has admitted his own guilt. So, I mean, you end up in this perplexing situation. It's a good thing to fix it. I mean, if this gives you an opportunity to fix it, why not take that chance?
Why is it perplexing? I don't follow this. What's perplexing?
Well, I think the point to be made here is that we ought to look at this. If our premier national police agency can't get it right in the largest domestic terrorism investigation in history, what can we rely on them ever to get it right? And the answer is that we don't have any confidence.
Kate, did they get it right? Do you think he's guilty?
Mr. McVeigh has admitted his own guilt, so I'll just leave it there.
Thank you.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm not disagreeing with you. I think that they do risk prosecuting people who are guilty if they screw this up. And then how about the innocent people that get thrown in the mix?
How can you say things like that?
Because there have been 90 people released from death row.
I'm talking about McVeigh's case.
Oh, no. I'm talking about all cases in general. I mean, this is a system-wide thing. That's where you have a chance to make some improvements.
Kate, can I weigh in on this?
Sure, please.
I agree very much in some ways with what this gentleman, the caller, is saying. What we're talking about is if a terrorist commits an act, he blows up something, okay? If at the end of the day we abandon our justice system in order to put him down, then he's done what he started out to do, because the heart and soul, the strength of this country is the fairness in our justice system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're worried about.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it's, he won. The guy, whoever did the thing, won, and that's what this is about. Let's do this stuff. Let's do this action that we're going through fairly. And I think all of us would agree with that. We want fairness.
Yes, I agree. Absolutely.
And if I may, I think we're also talking in the broadest sense about our trust in government. You touched on that, Rob. You know, if that's shaken and if the system isn't relied upon, we're in trouble, too. Another point to consider. Connection listeners, the number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Bob is calling from Iowa.
Yeah. Hello?
Bob, welcome.
Yes. Mary was on the phone shortly ago, and she said that maybe we need a new form of government. She did not say a violent revolution. She said a new form of government. She might have been thinking of a parliamentary form, as England has. And you said, no, we don't need a new form of government. The system is definitely working, and we are using this form of government to solve the problem. And it was just a few minutes later when one of your guests said, we are getting close to a dictatorship. The only people in the FBI who were fired over the revelations were me and my wife. The other people who are guilty of doing these wrong things within the FBI will not be fired. There are two different stories being told. My head is spinning.
There are lots of stories being told.
Amen to that.
There are lots of stories being told. Fred?
The system does function. I used the system. I didn't break the law. I did use the system. I used the courts to make the system function. When we are telling people that they can't look at the evidence against them in a court of law, that they're guilty and they're not allowed to review the evidence, scientific evidence, we're getting close to a dictatorship. This, our form of government, it can be used to stop that.
And Bob,
and it is being used to stop that.
Bob, thank you for the call. And I should point out that you're all right. It's some of all of the above. Part of the system is, and part of the system isn't working. But I want to move on. Thank you for calling. I want to move on to Rob with a kind of a closing question, and anybody else who's with us contribute. There is no current director of the FBI. Louis Freeh has resigned. President Bush has to name a new one. The FBI in the future, what ought to happen, and specifically, what kind of director do we need? Freeh was brought in as a reformer, remember. Rob?
Well, I think that we should rename the J. Edgar Hoover Building in honor of Fred Whitehurst, for one thing.
There you go, Fred.
Stop it right there.
Dinner's on you, Fred.
I would hope that during this confirmation process that members of Congress, the Senate, do take a hard look at what a new director proposes to do with the FBI, because certainly under Louis Freeh, this has just been an absolute disaster. I think that by all accounts, he is an honorable man, well-intentioned, but there is a culture of a huge office here that it's really going to be a major undertaking to change, and we need to change that culture. It needs to be made clear to every incoming agent that the job here is to find the truth and present the unvarnished truth.
Rob, in 20 seconds, can a head of the agency change its entire culture?
Well, the head of an agency is the most important person in any organization, the chief executive officer of a corporation. That's where it starts, and that's where the tone is set. And it's much harder in a bureaucratic organization where, with the change of an administration, there will be a change in a director.
That's where
that's
we start.
Where it starts. That's where we start.
Thank you, callers. The conversation continues, of course, but for the while, thanks to our guests, Rob Warden, Executive Director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions, Northwestern University School of Law, and Dr. Fred Whitehurst, founder of the Forensic Justice Project, and the man who blew the whistle on the FBI crime lab, to Kate McCauley, former Timothy McVeigh defense investigator and one of the people invited to witness his execution, and earlier, Lois Romano, our guest from The Washington Post. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
This is WBU.